Well, hi, everybody. Welcome. It's great to be back. I hope you've discovered the ports for the recordings, if you're interested in hearing any portion of what we talked about again, and especially the two downloads, the outline and the resources, two separate downloads for printing, ideally. So, any clarifications or questions from our first seminar that would be helpful to discuss briefly before we move into our seminar today? We're going to be talking about the neuroscience of peak performance and moving into applying some of the mind and brain sciences to an application of the performance sciences that ideally will be helpful for coaching, for you personally, professionally, and for your clients. So we're going to do some practical applications that I think that you'll find interesting. Much of the research in these areas has been in the last very few years. So these are essentially new applications for the field of professional coaching, and I think you'll find them exciting. But let me pause again to ask if there are any clarifications from last time or any things that that you want to add or ask. And I do appreciate all of you who have sent in the responses to the questions I ask. It helps to give me some ideas about what will be most helpful to you, useful for what you're doing. So anything you'd like to add, from questions to answers to those questions? Anything to discuss briefly?
This is Willie.
Okay,
I still haven't received those questions. I only received the original email from you.
That was the original email that had those two questions. And it just reminded you of the location of the downloads and the playback. So those two questions, and they're briefly just, what would you most like to get out of this seminar series? And when you walk away at the end of it, what would be the best response or experience that you have had in learning for your application and your coaching practice? So anything right now, Willie, just right off the cuff.
Right now, for me, is to be able to better serve my clients and helping them with stress management and just having the strategies to help them through that.
Okay. And that will be in specific ways, as they may ask for stress management, but it may simply be in subtle ways, as you hear a client began with indicating that they're upset or they're preoccupied or that there's some indication that they are in a state that's other than grounded and centered. So a very simple response is to empathically resonate with that experience and just reflect back that you hear how upset they are, or I hear that this is confusing. That can be grounding and centering for someone. In working with a client, we always want to keep in mind state comes before strategy and story, because the state of mind determines the mindset someone boots up to use to address the issues. We talked about a simple application that the brain activates in the same way for anxiety and excitement. If you frame it as anxiety, it boosts up a different mindset, dealing with it in a different way than if you frame it as challenge, as opportunity, as excitement, and recognizing that it's new and different. So that's a different mindset. So this is something that we do in very subtle ways and sometimes in more specific ways in developing strategies with somebody. So that's a good question and a ubiquitous issue, to be able to monitor the state of mind of our client and recognize when we may need to address the process to help them regulate that in a way that they can optimally be in a state that is designed for what they're doing, a state of mind, the software program that fits the task. And we talked just briefly, for example, creative writing and editing, two different parts of the brain, two different software programs, not to mix the two, but to be able to select and get immersed and frame what you're doing to fit the task. So this is something that we're doing while we're listening to other things and not getting totally lost in the content, because this is the process that we're listening for. So Willie, does that make sense in terms of your question?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Great. Anyone else? Anybody else dare after that ask a question? I promise I'll be briefer and much more succinct. Any other comments or thoughts before we launch into our material? Okay, well, I'll put us on lecture mode so you don't have to worry about managing the background, and then I'll reserve some time at the end for discussion and questions. So anything you have, jot it down. And remember, I mentioned that one application of using the output channel is to jot down any important takeaways that you have, at least at the end of the seminar, to jot down your most important takeaway from that seminar. And just putting it in the output channel by writing it, it will make it more memorable and more complete for you. So, okay, to talk about the neuroscience of peak performance, we're going to first talk about a confidence blueprint. And here's a brief story to frame this. Olympic gold medalist Nuruddin Marcel of Algeria said, "When I race, my mind is full of doubts. Who will finish second? Who will finish third?" Dr. Denton Cooley, a medical colleague in Houston, offered his version. "When you're asked to name the top three surgeons in the world, you should have trouble thinking of the other two." Now, that may border a little bit on overconfidence, but neuroscience does show that the state of mind of confidence is more correlated with success than competence or expertise. Confidence is a state of mind. Confidence is both art and neuroscience, and this state of mind initiates access to the mindset containing the necessary skills established by deliberate practice. Think about a very simple version of this. Remember in college when you saw your buddies, of course not you, your buddies pull the all-nighter and be all coffeeed up and study for the test. If they didn't take the test in that same state, they didn't have access to all that they jammed in their brain during that binge session of studying, and they couldn't access it. If they did access it, they'd have to stay in exactly the same state. We'll return to that. Here's another illustration. David Scott Yeager assigned 44 seventh grade students to write an essay about a personal hero. The teachers marked the essays and then provided written feedback. The researchers divided the essays randomly into two piles. In one, they added a generic note in the teacher's handwriting saying, "I'm giving you these comments so that you'll have feedback on your paper." The essays in the second pile, remember randomly picked, received a note saying, "I'm giving you these comments because I have very high expectations and know that you can reach them." For those students who received the generic note, 40% revised their papers. For the ones who received the encouraging high expectation notes, 80% revised their papers and made more than twice as many corrections as the first group. Confidence, like any state of mind, is contagious. Beliefs are a feeling of certainty about what something means. When you have a certainty, your brain will find a way. Here's something that has now been demonstrated in brain science. Listen to this because I think it's really important. Belief in someone transforms a state of mind in the recipient to a more creative, integrative state. That's why it's important that we believe in our clients. That's the criteria of who I will work with, someone in whom I believe, because then I know that that person will show us both why. Success most often has to do with two things: the state of mind of confidence that we engage an endeavor, and how we manage optimum practice and performance under pressure-inducing circumstances. So confidence, then, is a belief that you can create a successful outcome through what you do. It's initially subjective. It's an emotional regard of a promise that you then live into. Confidence is an internal sense that I can make this work. Optimism is a belief that everything's going to work out. Notice how much more personal with ownership confidence is. Confidence projects competence in a number of studies of practicing experts and their recommendations. So let's now apply the neuroconditioning chart we talked about last seminar to create an optimum state of confidence. So rather than starting with a negative emotional trigger, start with a positive one. The idea of those first two columns is not to begin with something negative, but to recognize as quickly as possible what is triggering an emotional response that's not productive. And instead of getting instantly lost in that column two, in the time capsule, to recognize that as quickly as possible in order to move to column three, the mantra, to do the cue, the focus, the physiology, and move into an ideal state. Here's a simple example. My daughter wanted me to join her to run a portion of the Boston Marathon with her from the day she was in college there. She wanted me to join her at Boston College and for us to run together the last 7 miles to the finish line. She learned how hard it was to qualify for the marathon with both sponsorship and times. She got her doctorate and moved back to Boston to practice, and it became a reality when she qualified and obtained sponsorship. For me, excited and horrified kind of blended. I'm a lifetime athlete, but distance running is absolutely not my thing. Running has always been in relation to some ball. I knew I was going to have to develop some way to sustain focus and tolerate the rigors and pain of training to cross the finish line together. One of my favorite sayings is this: fate whispered to the warrior, "You cannot withstand the storm." The warrior whispered back, "I am the storm." Every time when I was training, day after day, that times that I would have otherwise quit early or rationalized about stopping because of pain, that mantra, "I am the storm," sustained my effort. So many "I am the storms" later, we crossed the finish line shoulder to shoulder. So how does this work now? The brain chemistry that establishes optimum confidence is led by serotonin, the neurochemical messenger that helps us remain calm and make rational decisions. Confidence establishes ample serotonin in the prefrontal cortex, the command center of the brain for rational thought and decision making. Now, in brain chemistry, there's an inverse ratio of stress and confidence. When there's psychological threat and anxiety perceived, the challenge is to regulate the state of mind to maintain serotonin and sustain confidence. Another transmitter that's directly related and affects confidence is oxytocin. This chemical transmitter mediates bonding and connection and fosters an internal mindset of confidence. This connection can be to important others or even to an internal ideal. Here's a related application. And this is important in coaching. Neuroscience research shows that the first words spoken in a conversation trigger a neurochemical reaction in the listener to boot up a specific mindset in the listener. The mindset then processes the remainder of that conversation in terms of meaning and significance. Now, this is huge. I'll give you an example in saying this is huge for any leader, from business to sports to parenting to mentor coaching. So, a conversation that begins with remarks that are perceived as possibly critical or authoritative or adversarial or challenging activates the brain defensive circuitry of fight, flight, or freeze, mediated by stress chemicals, cortisol, and adrenaline. So the listener, from the first few words, experiences then a degree of guardedness or anxiety or distrust and closes down for self-protection. The subsequent conversation continues to be viewed from that mindset. Now, consider a different beginning. If those first few words are different, a conversation that begins in a collaborative mode, which is exactly what we do in coaching, activates oxytocin, the brain's neurochemical system that's related to bonding and connection. This initial experience and perception of a collaborative, trusting discussion induces a desire to listen without judgment, to pay full attention, to participate, and it frames the remainder of the conversation. The listener can feel safe, heard, understood. Trust develops with openness to further collaboration to optimize performance and results. This is the framework that we use in coaching, a collaborative framework. So building confidence requires, actually demands, hard work, risk, persistence, even tolerating failure. Gaining confidence regularly means going outside a comfort zone and tolerating setbacks with determination and resilience. So here's a limiting assumption that you'll hear in your clients. Comfortable and confident are not prerequisites, but they're the result of effective engagement. If you wait until you're confident or wait until you're comfortable, that can be a very limiting assumption. How then can you prime your mind and brain to prepare for an anticipated situation and establish a mindset of confidence? Well, here's how not to do it. And this is from Alexander Wolf in Sports Illustrated. By yelling at his point guard for missing that wide open teammate in the corner, the coach ensured that it's going to happen again. Now, a common perception is that the best way to get employees or players to perform is by pointing out mistakes or threats or being intense. And negative emotions grab attention, but a positive focus works considerably better to develop confidence as a mindset and the associated aspects of loyalty, bonding, personal development, and commitment to a group. So priming of mind and brain to prepare an anticipated situation establishes the foundation of a mindset of confidence. So here are 7 strategies for successful priming for confidence. This is just one example. Have a mantra for grounding and centering. Something you can do in 2, 3, 4 seconds. Ask yourself positive, powerful questions to induce serotonin. Recall recall a time of significant successful accomplishment of a similar challenge. Identify moments of significant confidence, a feeling of, I can do it, or whatever it takes, or I got this. Remember my little buddy at Steamboat Springs, when I told my wife that story, she said, someday, two or more decades from now, she's going to be in the delivery room, and she's going to scream out for every professional there to wonder, what is going on? I got this. Mental imagery of success to live into. A vision, a quick snapshot of what success is. And also cultivate a circle of support people and mentors. Now, here's another example of this in a kind of a goofy way, but for those of you who have played the game Taboo, I'll bet most of you have played it. It's a game where you get on a card a target word that you've drawn randomly, you haven't seen it before, and you want your partner to say that given word with your clues and gestures, and then there's a list of all the words you can't use, all the taboo words that would make it too easy. So the target word and then all the words that you can't say on that card. Think about when you've played it. Think about how hard it is once you've seen those six words not to say, how impossible it is to get those words out of your mind and think of something positive other than one of those six taboo words. If you say one of those taboo words, you lose the point. So often what you should not say can frame and dominate thinking to make it hard to go beyond the taboo words or what you want to focus on to offer reasonable clues. People have more comfort and confidence to go further when they carry the best parts of the past forward. Appreciative inquiry. This is a whole field of study that I think needs more to be applied to coaching. Looks at how a person or organization can study and define the best that there is, and then use the information to build on what's already working. Dr. Diana Whitney is the founder of Appreciative Inquiry, a colleague who was a guest of mine in a mastermind group. And I want to just summarize this because I think it's important. She described systematic studies of appreciative inquiry that show three major aspects. Focus on what works enhances what works. Think about how different that is than problem solving. And consultants who go in and ask about problems. I'll get back to that in a minute. So rather than problems and barriers, ask what you want more of. Secondly, focus becomes reality. A focus on possibility elicits a positive mindset. Focus on problems elicits a problem mindset. And this kind of focus awakens possibility, an aha experience. Appreciative inquiry studies by David Copperfield applied this to consultancies with different organizations, and he did match studies with larger organizations. When he went in to ask about problems, the traditional role, they talked about that. When he went in and asked for the challenges and the possibilities, significantly greater results and more success resulted. The question launches the story, because the initial comment frames the conversation. Do you ask a question? You have someone who participates then and collaborates with you. A head athletic coach who attempted to lead his team to victory told him, I know what it takes to win games. I know how to condition the players and to map game strategy. I lead the team by letting each player know what I expect of him and exactly what to do. Well, the problem was this didn't work. The result was the team was not even close to peak performance and winning results. The coach could not understand why his players were not taking his directives. The outstanding athletes did not feel valued, respected, but instead felt judged and criticized. How you engage establishes a context. If you tell, there's a pushback. That's the brain's job description. If you ask, it engages curiosity and collaboration. So let's apply this now to mindfulness practice and peak performance, ultimately to peak practice leading to peak performance. When Phil Jackson introduced mindfulness meditation after taking over as head coach of the Chicago Bulls, they won 6 NBA championships. Then, as coach of the LA Lakers, he again introduced mindfulness meditation to his team. They won 5 NBA championships. In a study in the Journal of Cognitive Enhancement, researchers at the University of Miami found that expert athletes who practice mindfulness for 12 to 15 minutes a day were more able to withstand emotional and mental demands of physical training, had greater resilience, and more sustained focus. The essential simplicity of meditation is to focus on one thing, such as your breath, and give full attention to that focus. When your mind wanders or you have a thought, which is the job description of your brain, it will inevitably happen. Notice this in order to let it go and move back to refocus on your breathing. You'll do this again and again. Gradually, over time, you'll have to do it less, but you'll still have to do it. When your mind wanders again, refocus again. Being aware of this process is a way of being aware of awareness. This selective attention aligns the energy field of your brain. Think of this as an elegant and simple metaphor for what we do in coaching. We began with a question, what would you like us to focus on? And then when the client says, I need a 15-year career plan, we ask another focus question, what aspect of that would be helpful to focus on now for you to get some traction? And what we don't say is to then establish a systematic way of going about that so that ultimately when we're not talking, you have internalized that model of systematically pursuing something. Now, I've included in the outline one example of a mindfulness meditation exercise that takes 1 to 2 minutes. I've sent it to clients at times in certain situations. I've recommended that they plan to do this periodically throughout the day, maybe before a board meeting specifically, or before something that's really important for them, some kind of performance or engagement or interaction that's important, to see how effective it can be for them. Consider ending the meditation with a specific gratitude, something you're grateful for in present time. As you're aware of the relaxed state of your mind, muscles, the steadiness of your heartbeat. After you do this mindfulness meditation and open your eyes, you're aware of the relaxed state and focus on present awareness. So in a number of studies, a focus on gratitude, a brief, simple gratitude, boosts energy levels, enhances resilience, and increases beneficial hormones in the body. This mindfulness training can be a specific, deliberate practice component of optimizing performance. Physiological changes in the brain with these practices have been shown to generate faster learning, decrease stress, and enhance performance. So, let's consider this question. Consider this for yourself first. Are you getting better at the things you most care about? Or are you not improving much at things or something, perhaps, that matters to you despite spending a lot of time working hard at it. Now, the prevailing theory for decades was that experience was the key to expertise. The more somebody practiced, the more expert they became. 10,000 hours to develop significant expertise. Yet, compelling research shows that we don't gain experience from experience alone. Dr. Anders Ericsson spent his entire professional lifetime studying the elements of experts as they became experts. He studied the art and the science of how someone practices to become expert and what they do to perform exceptionally. Deliberate practice. Now, here's the zinger in this. Research reveals that after the initial couple of years in a profession, performance can plateau. This is usually a result of movement away from time in the learning zone to focus time in the performing zone. For example, older and more experienced physicians paradoxically can perform worse than younger, less experienced colleagues. The reason for this documented finding is initially not obvious. The younger physicians have received more current knowledge and training in school. Continuing education, though, of experienced physicians should easily bridge that gap. And the gap should be further widened by years of experience in the trenches. But this is not the case. What's missing, we know now, is deliberate practice. A conclusion that has been reached by extremely, extremely useful research in the performance sciences is that people don't gain experience from experience alone. Experience doesn't make an expert. How someone practices informs how someone performs. The vast majority of learning and growing occurs during practice, not during performance. Intense focus on crafting a specific goal with openness for input from a mentor or coach proves significantly more effective than massive repetition or regular practice. With artists, intellectuals, athletes, consistent findings was that neither experience nor practice was the crucial variable. Deliberate practice was. So expertise is not about the total number of hours of practice, as in the 10,000-hour rule, but the type of practice that fills those hours makes a crucial difference. In other words, the number of years of practice has no correlation with how successful a clinical psychologist is with his or her patients in some studies. A number of instances showed that significant expertise, such as physics professors, as well as practicing physicians, they did not do, the experienced professionals did not do as well as newcomers in their respective fields. Repetition of the same experience is different from deliberate practice focused on improving. So, practice itself can make you worse. Every shot that misses its mark makes your aim worse. This is the neuroscience of deliberate practice. The creation of muscle memory is a process of myelination, of rewiring your brain. Repetition of a specific intended motor skill rewires so that each time over and over it becomes faster, easier, smoother. The drawback is that a skill performed in the wrong way also gets hardwired. So the solution is not to try harder, but to try differently. For example, to approach a barrier from a different direction, such as to work with a teacher or coach, someone who's familiar with the obstacles and can suggest ways to overcome them. So, in other words, this is saying that practice does not make perfect. Practice makes permanent. And that's in terms of brain hardwiring. Only perfect practice makes perfect performance. So these are four simple ways distilled from a great deal of work in performance science about how to change your behavior. Identify the goals, determine the mindset and the behaviors to achieve that goal, develop a specific action plan, and then program new identity to incorporate the changes. Two challenges in changing any behavior. And you guys know this. You know this from working with clients. This may just be different words, or it may be the same words, but two things. Two challenges to change any behavior, even when somebody knows they need to change, even when they know what they're doing isn't working, but they still do it. The mind's inclination to create certainty by repetition of the known outcome. We can experience repetition and read it as effectiveness because we can predict the outcome. And this is a bias also to want immediate closure and predictability, even though it's not the result you want. That's why, remember, in beginning coaching, both you and the client wanted you to make suggestions, wanted you to answer problems or tell them what to do, or at least disguise it and camouflage it in some way so that it sounded like a question, but it was really a disguised way to suggest what to do, because it brings closure, and that's a relief for both of you. Even though it may not be the right answer, even though it may not work, it's still closure. And secondly, the challenge in changing behavior, the brain has rewired for repeated behavior and has an error detection mechanism that alerts to anything other than repetition of the familiar. Even if it's a good change, it still registers as change. This is not right. So let's talk then about the learning zone and the performance zone. This is important in getting better at anything. The characteristics of elite performers in business, sports, various endeavors are all similar, and they all start with a mindset. We have two distinct performance-related mindsets, a learning zone and a performance zone. In a learning zone, the goal is to improve, to concentrate on what you want to master, to expect to make mistakes and to learn from them. Deliberate practice occurs in this learning zone rather than in the performance zone. Now, in a performance zone, the goal is to do something as best as possible, to execute what's been practiced. The learning zone requires and maximizes growth and future performance. The performance zone maximizes immediate performance. Now, research on deliberate practice mindset shows that anyone can improve with the right approach. If you're not improving, it does not mean that you lack basic talent, but it may be because you're not practicing in the best way. So you will see in the outline the five specific activities in the learning zone. Focus on a specific skill. Pick one. Specify a specific goal, not broad like just getting better. Determine a challenge just beyond your comfort zone for that segment of practice. Use feedback with repetitions and adjustments on execution, and engage the guidance of a skilled coach or mentor to correct mistakes and introduce new possibilities. That's a distillation of several years of research on what it takes to get better. So practice doesn't make perfect, it makes permanent. Practice of a slightly incorrect skill sequence will result in permanent etching of that sequence. The right kind of practice carried out over a sufficient time leads to improvement. Deliberate practice is significantly more important in performance than predefined or predetermined talent or ability. Only deliberate practice with expert information and mentoring will result in enhancing expertise and developing skill. Deliberate practice modifies the structure and the function of the brain and increases the ability to perform skillfully. It always pushes a comfort zone and engages the growth mindset of moving beyond what's most comfortable to what's a bit better. Improvement always resides just outside a comfort zone. So I'm going to ask you to look at the 7 framework principles. I'm not going to go over all of them here, but ask you to look at those in the outline when you're ready to reflect on this and do it as your own exercise. That's why I'm not going to just go over them right now, because you may just register them, but look at each of these as 7 steps to focusing on a specific area or issue or skill that you want to grow and develop, and apply each of these 7 steps to deliberate practice in that area. Here's an illustration from a buddy of mine, New York Times multiple bestseller Jeanine Roth. I admire her work tremendously. Was an expert content contributor in my mastermind group. I didn't know this until I heard one of my coaches ask her. They ask her how she did her editing. How did she improve her writing? And Jeanine said that she never lets out any writing to be seen by anyone else until she has at least 30 edits. Each edit improves, refines, focuses, and as part of this process, for some of those edits, she gets feedback from savvy readers. I've been privileged to be a reader for some of that, so I realize how much she works at this. So here's another application that I think is really important: deliberate practice and mental representations. 100 CEOs were interviewed by Accenture to determine the skills needed for executive success. Of 14 abilities that were crystallized from these interviews, one particular ability summarized these characteristics: self-awareness. Think about that's exactly what we help our clients do. Self-awareness is the foundation of all deliberate practice. To know to ask is half the answer. To be able to reflect on oneself and performance requires this ability to be attuned to all levels of self and performance, and to incorporate the flexibility of taking in new and different information in order to change. So self-awareness is a particular systems understanding of the self to look both subjectively and objectively at patterns of emotion, behavior, attachment to others, including communication. The ability to see oneself, to recognize patterns, and to think systemically are important aspects of understanding our own dynamics and the dynamics of others. So a component of deliberate practice is developing a corresponding mental representation of the specific process and structure of that performance. This is the way that our brains download the patterns that are then repeated in performance. Mental representations allow you to see different patterns and live into them. Deliberate practice develops mental representations while you're doing all the physical things, if it involves that, that enhance and perfect performance and form the foundation of an internal model that then incorporates the changes to make them permanent. Researchers in this area, led by Erickson, emphasize that the central purpose of deliberate practice is to develop mental representations that organize the execution of skills. Deliberate practice is designed to make these representations improve over time. And to put that simply, it's so that you can do things in a performance flow without thinking about them. Think about how at the very beginning you would pause and wonder if you're asking the right question or what's the next best question to ask this client. When you get in that performance flow, in that flow of conversation, you're focused entirely on the client. You're not pausing to think about it. In sports, that's a choke. Yogi Berra said you can't think and hit at the same time. When you're in that flow, you're not thinking about what you do. You're not an observer. You're in that experienced flow, the total immersion in an activity, resulting in a default experience that relies on mental representation. Even a nanosecond of moving to an observer's position or thinking about performance can derail that automatic flow pattern. Elite performers have trained to be able to make the right decision at the right time without thinking about it. A soccer goalie intercepts an incoming shot in a nanosecond of response. A race car driver accelerates precisely at the instant of a cornering turn. I've worked with two race car drivers who described this experience, but have difficulty in deconstructing the elements of exactly how they do it. The link between perception and action, the time between seeing and doing, is instantaneous and precisely formed. I've seen the fastest land animal, a cheetah in Africa, run at an amazing speed and be able to instantaneously shift course in order to avoid an obstacle or to pursue a prey. The unconscious pattern development is installed by deliberate practice. I want to talk about the last shot, okay? When I began playing basketball with my son and daughter in the driveway, we would never end on a miss. They had, by my requirement, and I didn't know what I was doing at the time, they had to make the last basket they shot before we stopped. I thought it would just be, you know, a good memory. A period at the end of it. Later, when I coached their basketball teams, each player had to make the last basket he or she shot before we ended practice. Now, I sort of knew intuitively that endings make a difference. Even brief, seemingly meaningless endings of driveway basketball or our Tuesday night team practice. Later, I would learn of Dr. Daniel Kahneman's research on peak performance, the Nobel Prize winner, that the two times of the most impactful experience and subsequent memory are at the moment of greatest emotional impact and the ending. My son, 2 years older than my daughter, taught me about the importance of a performance state of mind. With his being the first team I ever coached at his age 8, we'd gather together as a group in our home gym the day of the game, shoot around briefly, and go over the few rudimentary plays that we had. The team would all pile into my car. Now, remember, this was an era before mandatory seatbelts. Drive to the gym where we would play on the way Eye of the Tiger. Got them all in a raucous mood to really go at it with basketball. They would sing along at high volume, got everybody in the spirit of the game. Later, when I coached my daughter's all-girl basketball team, when she reached age 8, we began practice in the same way, with a little inspirational talk, teamwork, moving directly into basics, and then scrimmage. It didn't work. They were distracted. They didn't seem to respond. It's like they were there for something besides basketball. I was baffled. As I listened to them and observed more closely, I began to get a clue about what I had missed. Basketball was the content of the practice, but their state of mind focused on the process of being together, of playing together. I was urging them to concentrate on being competitive, running plays. They just wanted to enjoy themselves and each other. Soon, we began each practice. Our warm-up was sitting in a circle on the court, just talking. That was their warm-up, and it worked. They played better as a team. Same thing for pre-game warm-up. We all piled into my car and gossiped on the way to the game. How strange, yet wonderful, I thought it must be to be a girl, to be not focusing on winning, and to apologize when you foul an opponent was never a consideration for me. My daughter still contributes to my continuing education by giving me 4 granddaughters. So let's talk for a moment about unlearning. I want to reserve some time at the end for discussion. Ben Fletcher at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK devised a study to get people to break their usual habits. I think this is a study that was tailor-made for coaches, even though he didn't have this in mind at the time and his team. Each day, subject picked a different option from polls of contrasting behaviors, lively, quiet, introvert, extrovert, reactive, proactive. They would pick one and then behave accordingly, according to their choice, for the entire day. So an introverted person, for example, would act as an extrovert for the entire day. Additionally, twice weekly, they would choose to eat something they had never eaten before or read something they had never read before. Now, what do you think the biggest change after 4 months of doing this, 5 days a week, was for this group? The remarkable finding to me and to the research team, who was baffled initially, the subjects lost an average of 11 pounds. 6 months later, they had all kept the weight off and most continued to lose weight. Now, this was not a weight loss or a diet study, but a study focusing on change and its impact. Here's what they concluded. Asking people to change routine behavior makes them actually think about their decisions rather than habitually choosing a default mode without consideration, to begin by making a choice. So this is story busting in an indirect way to create awareness of choice architecture, which is what we do in coaching. In having to process decisions actively, they exercise their choice and decision-making options and extend it to other choices such as what to eat and what not to eat. They became aware that every bite they took was a choice rather than just taking 2 or 3 bites and automatically eating whatever's there. So they began to ask with each bite, is this bite in my best interest? So the brain changes when we learn something new. Each step of learning must involve at the same time an unlearning. So why is it so much easier for a child to learn a foreign language? The beginner's mind is the essence of this process of not having to forget or unlearn something and to replace it with the newly acquired, but simply learn something new. So inevitably, though, much must be unlearned in order to replace it with the new, like forming a new habit when one already exists. Learning is not the simple acquisition of information. If you believe it is, try it with your clients. More importantly and more vividly, try it with the first teenager you cross paths with. Give them information, facts, or opinion. See how it works. This means that the old ways of doing things, such as an ingrained attachment pattern played out in the business relationship, they're already there. Doing a slightly different forehand, a slightly different stance in tennis, is not as easy as seeing it instructed and adopting the moves. A habit simply means you have, by repetition, rewired your brain to make a particular behavior or thought pattern automatic with specific cues. Once a habit's in place, it's an anatomical reality in your brain with corresponding neuronal pathways and networks to execute that habit. Simply presenting an alternate or a better pattern does not overwrite the programming already in your brain. Change can occur, but it's a process of doing a new behavior and undoing the one that it replaces. These are the neural substrates of learning new skills, whether physical or cognitive. So a habit engages software already created for an experience. If it's useful, it can tremendously expedite a default and effortless execution. You don't have to think about it. If it's no longer useful or if it's outdated, this is where we earn our money, new behavior patterns need to be created. A simple strategy becomes not to fight old habits, because that's just another way to engage them, but to start new ones. All the associations of the past habit can then be replaced by immersion in a current new experience. So this is basically self-directed neuroplasticity. The ability to unlearn is strategic. If something recurs, if you do find yourself doing or saying something that you don't like, that is not working, can't seem to get past it, here's a three-step, simple, self-directed neuroplasticity. Three unlearning steps. Relabel the automatic old content or practice as an error message from your brain. Your brain is simply doing its job. It's repeating what's already been hardwired. If it's not working, label it as an error message from your brain. Reframe this false brain message not as a directive for action, but focus on what is positive, on what you want. So immediately reframe it and then focus on the desired next step. So the three R's, relabel, reframe, and refocus. So this pruning of the old unused pathways occurs a lot during our sleep. This is why maybe we wake up from a good night's rest, we're able to think more clearly and quickly. But this is a strategic mechanism that we can address in waking time. So here's something I wanted to mention. I alluded to this about putting it in an output channel. And I'll close with this because I want us to be sure and have even a brief time to respond. If you were to take a test on paper, 8 pages in length, which of these methods would result in the greatest success? Reading those 8 pages 4 times in a row, trying to memorize them. Reading the 8 pages once, putting down the paper, and writing a 1-page summary. Well, research shows that the second strategy of putting knowledge into action results in a 50% greater success. When an output channel is mobilized in the brain, it creates new neuronal networks and pathways to begin rewiring the new information to complete a brain cycle. It makes it more memorable, more retainable, and then more available for reference. So this is important. And think about what we do in coaching. We ask a client 2 questions at the end of a coaching session that engages this output channel. We ask, what's a brief summary of the most important thing you're taking away? And then based on that, what do you commit to do in the next week that can give you some traction? So we are asking a patient, collaborating with a patient, to put the essence in their words, not us summarizing for them, to put it in their words and to put it into an action channel. A body in motion tends to stay in motion. A body at rest tends to stay at rest. That's how we're wired. So we need a plan and a strategy for change. And remember, in closing, the brain hardwires what we repeatedly do, whether it's good or bad. And when we attempt to change, it resists. Both our mind and our brain resist, and the error detection mechanism adds because it activates to say this isn't what's expected. The brain error detection mechanism alerts to anything other than repetition of the familiar. This is why it is so challenging to help our clients really engage change. We're in discussion mode now, so if you'll manage the background noise, I'm eager to hear if there are any questions or clarifications about what we've talked about or anything that you are particularly gathering from what we talked about that's helpful to you. Any of the above?
Well, the one thing that I really liked was the state of mind and confidence outweighs skill.
Expertise and skill, yes. Again and again, it shows. Because the confidence boots up a mindset, and when the mindset contains deliberate practice, those skills are already there. So It's just the access to that mindset where the skills have been developed. Here's an example of that. There was a challenge. There was a softball pitcher, a woman softball pitcher, whose fastest underhand softball was 72 miles an hour. And Jenny challenged some of the best hitters in Major League Baseball at the time, who were accustomed to hitting 90 to 100 mile an hour fastballs and were the best batters of their time, Albert Pujols, a number of batters. And they scoffed at her challenging them to hit her softball. The ball is twice as big as the baseball, and it comes the fastest at 72 miles an hour. They're accustomed to hitting something 20, 25 miles an hour faster. Of all the batters, only one batter at one time barely tipped the ball. Nobody else hit it. She knew this because the patterns that are hardwired to develop in someone's brain, the elite skill of hitting an overhand baseball, is very different from the innate patterns, the skill set patterns that are developed in the brain to read and respond to an underhanded softball. Totally different, and they had no way of adapting or adjusting that quickly. They all struck out to their embarrassment. But one person, Barry Bonds, when he saw what was happening, he refused to go to the plate. He was the only one who didn't strike out. I'm sorry, I had planned for more time. Any other brief thought or question that we can respond to if you're okay to go over a minute or so? I want to respect our time. Also to mention, if you'd like to have a more extended time for discussion and question and answer, let's add 15 minutes at the top of the hour to our last seminar, to week four, so that we can have more of an exchange. But anything else you want to add or ask right now, just briefly? Well, if something comes up during the week, fire an email, and I'll incorporate in our discussion, or be ready at the beginning of next seminar to ask or comment or add your thought or observation or question. I hope this is helpful to you. I'll be eager to hear. Don't hesitate to email me. I look forward to picking up right here next time. Thank you all very, very much. Have a great rest of the week, and take good care of yourself. See you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye now, thanks.
Bye.